on Tuesday, October 13th, the last of the four events in the Bozeman Candidate Forum series was held. This series was sponsored by the American Association of University Women Bozeman, the Belgrade Community Library and Bozeman Public Library, the League of Women Voters Bozeman, and the Bozeman Business and Professional Women. And this last forum featured the ballot issues that are on the ballot for this general election in 2020. The event was held as a virtual teleconference. We recorded it, and we hope you find it informative.
Welcome, everyone, to tonight's Ballot Issues Forum. Thank you for joining us. My name is Melissa Heron. I am the nominations chair with Bozeman Business and Professional Women. And we are an organization who supports women personally, professionally, and politically. Tonight's forum is sponsored by Bozeman Business and Professional Women, the Bozeman Public Library, the Belgrade Community Library, the League of Women Voters of the Bozeman Area, and the American Association of University Women Bozeman. Thank you to our sponsors for planning and working on these events. This is the last night of a virtual series of forums. We had hosted the candidates running for various offices the last few nights, and tonight is the last night where we will talk about the ballot issues that will appear on the ballot. All of the past forums were recorded, and tonight's will be recorded as well. So you can find all of the recordings for this forum series on the YouTube channel for the Belgrade Community Library if you'd like to share them or rewatch them. And you can also find them on the Bozeman BPW website, bozemanbpw.org. All right, so here's a reminder about voting and about absentee ballots. Reminder that the absentee ballots have gone out. And if you aren't registered to vote, you can do so by visiting the Secretary of State website at sosmt.gov/elections. Voter registration closes on October 26th. Ballots can be completed and turned in via mail, in person at a polling location, or in person at the county courthouse on election day, which is November 3rd. And on that day, November 3rd, same-day voter registration and in-person voting will be available from 7 a.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. All right, so the agenda for tonight's forum, so that everyone knows the order of things. We have a few different ballot issues to review with the panelists. The first section is a section that's going to start shortly, is on the ballot issues number 11 and 14, which are related to the legalization of marijuana and details regarding that initiative. That is going to run from now until about 7:20. Then there's going to be a switch of panelists. The next panelists will come on and we will talk about LR 130, which deals with revising concealed carry laws. Then that forum will run until about 8:15. And at 8:15, then we'll switch over to the final panelists who will talk about C46 and C47, which deal with the revision of signature requirements. So there will be three sections for tonight. So for our first section, we're going to do some introductions of the panelists. Then we'll have opening statements, opening introductions for each panelist. And then they're allowed to make a 5-minute statement about the ballot issue that they are either supporting or opposing. And then we will open up to questions from the public. After the public Q&A is finished, then we can do closing statements from the panelists, and then I will adjourn that section of the forum and we'll take a little break to move on to the next section. Again, this is all being recorded, so everyone be on your best behavior. And a reminder for the rules for the panelists regarding being on your good behavior. Please remember that you are to be answering these questions from your organization's standpoint or your own point of view as an expert, but please do not use the time that you're answering to make comments toward your opponent's point of view or your make personal attacks against your opponent. Okay? Thank you. The timer again will indicate when you're ready to stop or when you have 30 seconds left. And if anyone's talking over time or if anyone's breaking these rules, then we'll just mute you and then we'll move on. All right. Great. So let's welcome the panelists and get started. Before we do your introductions, I would like to ask each panelist as I say your name to please wave so that the audience knows where they're oriented on the screen. So Pepper Peterson from New Approach Montana campaign, can you please wave? Great. Hello. And then Steve Zabawa with Wrong for Montana, can you please wave? Excellent. Great. And then the timekeeper, Sarah, will you wave? Great. And I'm the moderator. Okay. So now we are going to move into the section where each panelist can offer a 2-minute introduction for themselves and the organization that they're here with. So Sarah will start the timer when you begin speaking. And if we could please have Steve go first.
Well, thank you, Melissa, and it's a pleasure to be in front of the Bozeman Business and Professional Women, so thank you very much for putting this on. Number one, I'm Steve Zabawa. I'm the treasurer for Wrong for Montana. We're opposed to recreational marijuana coming to Montana. And who is Wrong for Montana? We just got together here at late of August once they found out that it was going to be on the ballot. So we had a lot of sensible families and individuals, as well as associations that contacted me and said, hey, we need to put an opposition together. We do not want what happened in Colorado. That's why we call it Wrong for Montana. Our associations include the Montana Chamber of Commerce and the car dealers. Their thoughts were that it's a workforce issue. More people on marijuana. Most companies do drug tests, and it becomes a real issue to find people to work. The second associations were the motor carriers and the troopers. The troopers just joined us. They feel if they're worried about running all those huge semis and so forth on the roads, that there's going to be more DUIs out there if the amount of marijuana users increases like what Pepper and their team have just projected. They feel there's going to be 110,000 people buying an ounce of marijuana every month on top of the 38,000 blue card or green cards. So we're going to have a lot more people driving around, and hopefully people stay home if they do it. But chances are there's just like Colorado and Washington, fatality accidents went way up once it was legalized. And then the Family Foundation, they just don't believe in illegal drugs within their family, and they're very worried about it. And also the SAM, which is one of the associations that joined. That's a national firm that was started by Patrick Kennedy, and it's called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And very, very concerned. They helped North Dakota in 2018 defeat this 60-40. And that's one of the other associations with us. So thank you for having us.
Thank you, Steve. And Pepper, you may start when you're ready.
Hi, I'm Pepper Peterson. I'm the political director for New Approach Montana. And New Approach Montana was started in late 2018. Ted Dick and I were looking at the decline in natural resource economy dollars in Montana, and we thought that we needed some new sources of revenue, and we thought that marijuana legalization was inevitable, and it was good to get ahead of it and go ahead and get a Montana-made solution to marijuana legalization that we felt would benefit the state greatly. And so we got to work on that, and when we dug into the policy, we realized very quickly that it was going to be a little more complicated than one initiative. It came down to the fact that we needed two initiatives because Montana has a very interesting issue in its constitution related to the rights of adults. Now, in 1978 and 1986, Montana passed constitutional initiatives to limit the age for alcohol consumption to 21 and or to give the legislature and the people the authority to set that age for alcohol consumption at 21. And so we went in and did the same thing for marijuana. We follow that precedent. Montana voters seem to be okay with making that tweak to the Constitution if it was something as important as restricting access to those 21 and over. And so we decided to move forward with that. And also I-190, which is really the meat of the policy, which legalizes, regulates, and taxes marijuana. Now, that's a 67-page document. It's a very tight piece of legislation that we cloned from the 2019 medical marijuana statute that the legislature produced. And so it's very familiar to the legislature and the people, generally the things that are acceptable and unacceptable on regulation. We see those things already. we didn't want to surprise anyone with anything that was out of the ordinary for Montana. And so we put the two initiatives on the ballot, and we got 130,000 signatures. That's a lot of Montanans. Ends up being about 10% of the population supported this policy by adding their signature. And so we got both initiatives qualified for the ballot.
Thank you, Pepper.
Thank you.
And so next, we have a 5-minute section of time where you can provide a statement to expand on your organization's positions on ballot issues 11 and 14. You can go into greater detail. And so we're going to alternate. So I'd like to actually start with Pepper, and you can continue.
All right, are you ready? Okay. Well, as I mentioned, we have two complementary initiatives. These are two complementary initiatives, CI-118 and I-190, and they work together to create marijuana legalization in Montana. And the way that works is CI-118 will restrict the age. It creates the authority for I-190 to restrict the age of consumption to 21 and over. And again, that was a constitutional change that was based on the restrictions for alcohol that we made in 78 and again in 86. And so we put that in place because otherwise we couldn't restrict it to 21 and over. And so although it complicated it tremendously, we felt that was necessary. We wanted it to be 21 and over. And so we moved forward with that and got I-190 together. And we spent a long time and a lot of effort, speaking of Montanans, beginning in early 2019, we started touring the state and asking Montanans, you know, what they think about legalization and how they like to see the policy written. And we went to all the major cities and we visited with community leaders and clergy and tribal leaders. And we talked to folks about, you know, what they wanted to see out of it and what they kind of expected, what kind of sideboards they were looking for. And everyone seemed very comfortable with what the 2019 legislature had produced in terms of rules and regulations and sideboards. And so it was easy to clone those regulations, bring them over into the recreational system. Just a few changes have been made. Like we moved the program over to the Department of Revenue. We felt it was more appropriate. We spoke to them about it and they said they're fully prepared to do it. They're the ones executing the taxation currently for medical marijuana. As you may know, early on when we had an early draft, we attempted to reduce and eliminate the tax on medical marijuana. But there's a single subject rule in Montana that says that your initiatives can only address a single subject. I-190 can only address recreational marijuana. So it doesn't touch medical marijuana at all. Although we wanted to, you know, reduce that tax, we weren't able to do that in statute because of the single subject rule. So what you see in the text of I-90 is specifically and explicitly related to recreational marijuana in Montana. Now, when we spoke to the University of Montana and we talked to them, you know, about what it was going to look like for a marketplace in Montana and what we could expect for taxation, their numbers reflected largely the numbers that the governor's budget office created. It was north of $50 million a year in tax revenue that would be generated from a 20% tax on recreational marijuana. And so, you know, looking at that revenue and looking at, again, the federal inevitability, the cascade of states that are coming down the line for legalization, we knew that we should get ahead of those things in Montana and design a system that we had control over. We did not want a situation where the feds may have legalized marijuana and 18 to 21-year-olds would have access. So we thought CI-118 particularly was vital to get passed before the feds legalized marijuana. And also, we'd like to make sure that we have our own taxation and implementation plans in place that reflect Montana values and reflect the attitudes and opinions of people in Montana. And so that's what you see in I-190 is that work that we put in over a year, gathering those opinions and working with experts and looking to do no harm first. We wanted to make sure that the regulations and sideboards that the medical marijuana community had gotten used to and had put in place that seemed very effective would be adopted over for recreational marijuana. And then it would, again, be limited to those 21 and over. And so as we've gone through the process, we've gotten the support of so many Montanans, and we really appreciate the community support out there. And we talk to a lot of people, especially vets, who say, you know, while they feel that the medical marijuana laws have been mostly effective, they've been left out of the system. And so we'd like to increase access for veterans to marijuana. And so this statute has those things in it. We also put expungement in here. I-190 addresses the wrongs of prohibitions passed. I think we all agree that marijuana arrests need to cease, and that it's more damaging to people's lives to be arrested for marijuana than it is to consume marijuana. And while we want to keep it out of kids' hands, it's important that we have a realistic and a standard approach as Montanans, something that's based on our values, not something that the feds hand us. And that was a big impetus behind what we've done here with I-190 and CI-118. And we feel like it's a very good program. We feel like the Montana legislature did their homework when they produced this program, and that's why we adopted it over. So we appreciate the support that everybody's given out there, and we encourage you to vote two times. Yes, it's CI-118 and I-190. You're going to see them on the ballot. Maybe you've got your ballot already. I've already turned mine in, so vote yes.
Thank you, Pepper, for your statement. And now, Steve, you can give your statement.
Thank you, Melissa. Let's start at the very beginning. Why did we name our opposition Wrong for Montana? Number one, who's funding this deal? Who's actually behind I-190? We filed a complaint with the Commissioner of Political Practice this last week, and he's already been investigating it for a couple months, and nobody's come clean. $4.7 million has been put into this deal from a company called North Fund out of Washington, D.C. You can't find out who that company is. It's only been around for a couple years, and they're protecting whoever the person is behind it. This is dark money out of state trying to come into Montana and stone our families. Think about that. When's the last time anything like this played well? Okay, so then as far as Pepper's comment, as far as going around and talking to Montanans, if you go around and talk to the medical marijuana people that have 260 dispensaries and then have over 38,000 green card holders that are dispensing marijuana right now throughout the state, they're not in favor of this. The ones I've known and talked to are not in favor of, they're opposing I-190. They feel it'll be a huge disruption to the distribution of marijuana in the state of Montana right now. They're fearful for their jobs. At least these jobs that are in the medical marijuana profession are here in Montana. They keep the profits in Montana. Everybody's registered. The marijuana is traced. And there's laws for, to make sure it's safe as far as mold and all the things. So we've done a lot of work over the last 4 years to get this right. And legalization at this time of recreational marijuana is going way too fast. We just got this one initiated. They're still working out at the Department of Health and Human Services. The bug's out of the deal if you talk to everybody, and they're very happy that it's moving forward in the right direction. They do not feel legalization at this time is a good idea. In fact, they met with Pepper, and they could not come to terms as far as the actual deal. Now, here's the next thing. This thing's all about revenue. All you hear from Pepper is revenue, revenue, revenue. Well, in the state of Colorado and the state of Washington and the state of California, the amount of revenue is less than 1% of the state budget. You got to remember, our state budget is like $3 billion. So $50 million sounds like a lot of money, but when you figure out all the things it's going to take care of all the issues, the Centennial Institute came out in Denver and said for every dollar of revenue Colorado brings in, they have to spend $4.50 to clean it up. So think about that when you're talking about this revenue. Now, the other problem is that this ballot initiative in Section 35, 38, and 39 actually allocates out the revenue to people and leaves only 10% of this in the general fund. Well, in the Montana Constitution, it says specifically you cannot allocate revenue to anybody. So why Pepper and the team have done this is to get the vets, to get the conservation group and everybody else to actually come on board and give them their vote. So they're out buying votes by promising people, the vets, the conservation groups, that they're going to be able to allocate this money to them. So that's a flaw in how they wrote the deal. So I think we got that problem. And then we got the dark money out of state problem. And then just in general, do we want more people in the state of Montana high? Now, their projections to get to their rosy 50 million, you have to have 110,000 adults go out and buy an ounce of pot per month at $270. Now, think about that. With the potency level of marijuana at 15 to 25% in just the normal marijuana they produce today, that basically stones one adult for the whole month every night. Do we really want that as far as our spouses, our people that operate on us, fix cars, do the things as on a workforce issue and as a family issue. So the other problem with marijuana, just in general, it is a Schedule I illegal drug. And the reason why the Montana Bankers Associations are against it also, I mean, these are major groups of players throughout the state. They feel it's going to be a disaster as far as trying to track all the money and all the things that come about of that, because they're trying to launder the money through all sorts of different ways because it's a federal illegal drug. So conclusion, it is wrong for Montana. We want to have a pristine, healthy, productive Montana. That's what our association's about. That's what our ballot action committee's about. And that's why we're so adamantly opposed to this. And that's why all the associations have jumped on board. And the only associations that have jumped on their board, they can't even get the medical marijuana people on their side. And the only other one that they've got is the people that they're handing money out to. So it's all about the money. And that's not a good reason to addict more of our families, you know, to this. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zavala. And before we proceed, a reminder, panelists, to please refrain from indicating your co-panelists by name, okay? Please stay in your perspective on the issue, please. Thanks. All right, so next we are actually going to open up now for questions from the public. And we have some questions that have come in via email and some that have come in so far on the question and answer. We are going to start with the emailed questions, and I will read them one at a time, and both panelists will have a chance to respond. Yes, the response time is 90 seconds. So the first question is addressed to Pepper. If these initiatives pass, will there be marketing restrictions so we're not inundated with marijuana advertising targeting kids, advertising in inappropriate mediums, or restrictions on sponsoring sporting events or activities that are targeting?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, we adopted the 2019 medical marijuana statute, and we cloned that into the recreational marijuana statute that we've written. It has all of those restrictions in place that you mentioned, all the testing in place that's been previously mentioned, all the safety, the regulations, all the things that you just mentioned are in place in the legislation. Absolutely.
Thank you for your response, Pepper. And Steve, do you want to make a comment on that question?
If you've been to Las Vegas or you've been down to Denver, there are more pot shops on every corner that you can imagine. Every billboard is green. They are very, very good at marketing and getting the word out. They're out to stone everybody in your family. So you got to be careful what you wish for. You do recreational marijuana, you're going to be looking at all sorts of billboards in your face. Everything's going to be green. Any empty building, there will be someone that will go in there with a marijuana shop. And this big marijuana person that's putting all the money in there, I have no idea what they're going to do. That's just go down and look at Denver or go look at Las Vegas, and that's what you're going to end up with, recreational marijuana.
Thank you very much, Steve. All right, so the next one is from the Q&A, and it is not to address to anyone specific. So I will read it out loud.
This is not feeling good on the couch.
All right, so it reads, what mechanism is in place to make it clear to growers where they may...
So we'll wait our customary 3 minutes and then we'll get started.
All right, and I'll read it again. What mechanism is in place to make it clear to growers where they may and may not plant? There's a next part of this. It says, who will be in charge of crafting and enforcing regulations to mitigate impacts on wildlife, on wild lands, agriculture and urban lands, water and real estate, and what will the cost be? And so this isn't addressed to anyone specific, but if you raise your hand, or a panelist, I can call on you and you can go first. So either of you want to take this on? You're muted, Steve. Do you want to say anything?
Yes, thank you. Conservation water. Marijuana takes a lot of water to grow. I think it's like 23 liters per plant per day. And then not only that, if it's grown inside, it takes just a huge amount of electricity to run the fans and get the humidity right and then make the things grow. So reclamation over in California, if you talk to anybody over there, it costs over $45,000 to go behind the marijuana growers over there. And they have gone bonkers all the way up and down the California coast growing this. So it's a real issue to be able to keep the black market right, keep the regular market right, and reclamation the deal. And from a conservation standpoint, it's we're so picky on oil and all the other things that we do here. I don't know why we'd want to do this particular type of crop. So anyway.
Thank you for that response, Steve. And Pepper, would you like to respond?
Yeah, the Department of Revenue is going to be engaging in a rulemaking process between passage and implementation. And again, they're using the rules that they use for the Department of Health and Human Services. We're using those rules very effectively in Montana. We don't have any environmental disasters from growing marijuana in Montana. Montana growers are very conscientious of the environment. All zoning regulations from cities and local governments will stay in place. Our regulation specifically allows for governments, local governments, to put restrictions on marijuana if they like to. And it's not going to change the amount of shops at all because, you know, zoning regulations largely govern that. And of course, for the first year, the only people who'd be able to grow or sell marijuana at all in Montana are the currently licensed medical marijuana providers who are following the rules that we have in place now very closely. And they're very closely monitored by the Department of Health and Human Services, and they will be by the Department of Revenue as well. We have a very tight tracking system for all of those things called Metric, you know, and it keeps a tight rein on the folks that are involved in the system. So it's going to be the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Revenue, and local governments. Again, that local control is something we wanted to keep in place and allow for governments to control where marijuana shops would be. The city of Helena has much more stringent restrictions than, say, the state of Montana even does. And so we wanted to allow those local governments to continue to put those restrictions in place and to govern their own fates as it relates to marijuana.
Thank you, Pepper. Thank you both. And we have another question that has come in through the Q&A. Again, this one is not directed to anyone specific, so we will just go for it and see who wants to take it on first. And the question is, can you clarify the different effects between the substances of alcohol and the substances of marijuana, the effects that these have on the human body, and why we need to regulate them? Does anyone want to go first? Okay. Steve.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. One of the things I've noticed in this discussion as far as alcohol and marijuana is that you can have a glass of wine, you can have a beer, and you can still drive an automobile. You can still conduct yourself in a normal method. When you drink 6 beers or 12 beers, depending upon the size of your body, you got issues, right? On marijuana, the THC content today is not like it used to be at 2 or 4%. The average marijuana is 15 to 20% now. And if you take a gummy bear, it can be as high as 98%, and a cookie can be as high as 98%. So one cookie can stone 8 people. Now, once you're stoned, you're pretty much, you're not able to drive. You know, so that's what I don't like about marijuana is that, you know, there isn't just a one glass of marijuana type high. You know, most people smoke it, hit the bong, and they get stoned because that's what they're trying to do. And then do they have to drive somewhere at that point in time? Do they expose that? Are they watching the kids? Or what are they doing, you know, as far as their lifestyle when they're doing the marijuana? Most employers do not want stoners as far as being stoned at work because it creates a problem when you're fixing a car or working on a human being or whatever you're doing. So it's going to open up a huge can of worms by legalizing and having more people stoned on a regular basis. So as far as the alcohol deal, you know, is one evil better than the other? I don't know. You know, that's going to be a lifelong discussion on that one.
Thank you, Steve. And Pepper.
Well, I'm not a doctor or a physiologist, and so I'm not going to offer any, you know, detailed chemical makeup of marijuana or alcohol consumption. I will say that in my experience, it's been alcohol is one of the most destructive things in our society. I think that it's insidious in some hands. I think that, you know, the fact is that Americans are adults and Montanans are adults, and sometimes they make a decision to drink, and that's their business. And we think they should be able to make the same decisions about marijuana. I think there's a lot of hyperbole being offered that doesn't have any fact backing it up about stoners and, you know, blood on the highway. I think that we've had a very successful marijuana program in Montana that shows that adults can govern themselves and they can make good decisions. Everybody's not going to make good decisions. That's the world. I wish that folks would make better decisions with alcohol. We're hoping that folks make good decisions with marijuana. We are not putting up a free-for-all for folks to come and do drug driving. If you're interested in that, then we're not interested in you. We want to make sure that the highways are safe. People can make decisions as adults that define them. I think that's a decision that defines people, whether they drive drunk or whether they drive stoned. I think that's a decision that each individual has to make. But putting people in jail for decisions that they make at home, no, I don't think so. That's not Montanan. That's not the American way of doing things. And we need to make sure that doesn't happen anymore.
Thank you, Pepper. So the next question is an emailed question. And it is not addressed to either of you, but I'm going to direct it first to Pepper. Sure. And then we can have Steve offer a response as well. And it reads, with these initiatives, will there be a THC cap or a maximum potency?
You know, that's a decision that we left up to the Department of Revenue. That's part of the rulemaking process. We've spoken to them at length about this. We went and met with the Department of Revenue, and, you know, we spoke to them at length about things they were interested in and what they'd like to see and what they were concerned about and, you know, what they'd seen in other states that might cause alarm. And they mentioned the fact that they might like to see potency limits on edibles. So, you know, I think that's something that's going to be done in the rulemaking process, and that's why we wrote the rules. As we did, you know, with the department having a long rulemaking process that the public can be involved in. And so, yeah, we expect that there are going to be boundaries that are put up by the Department of Revenue that do not exist for the medical marijuana market. I think it's inappropriate to look at THC limits for the medical marijuana market because you have cancer patients and people that might not be able to consume large amounts. They might need a small amount of something that they could consume in an environment that doesn't lend itself to smoking. And so those concentrates that have been around for centuries, like hash and hash oil, those might be better for folks like that. And so those are appropriate for the medical community. But it's the department and the legislature is going to have a say in that. And the people are going to have a say in that in Montana if they want to see potency limits on edibles and other THC products in the recreational market.
Thank you, Pepper. Mm-hmm. And Steve, would you like to answer that question?
Yeah, wrong for Montana. THC is a Schedule I illegal drug underneath the FDA. It's registered right there with heroin. Now, it could be Schedule II, could be argued about that. But at the end of the day, you know, think about the repercussions of THC within the body for someone that has depression issues, schizophrenia issues. And then you think about the youngsters, the 25 and unders down to 21, where their brain is still being formulated. And it does tremendous damage to anybody under 25 as far as the formation of the deal. We have a lot of issues that are unknown with THC and what it does to the body. And they've done a lot of testing, and we know there's all sorts of issues with lung and cardio with the deal, especially if you're smoking it. There's no so safe cigarette, right? So why are we doing anything like that, vaporizing and all the other things that go on? So this THC is a potency limit is definitely an issue. There was someone down in Denver. See, the problem when you legalize something or make it recreational, it's supposed to be fun, right? So everybody from the surrounding borders that aren't legalized come to your town to party. That's what they did in Denver. They come from the Wyoming College. They show up. They eat the full cookie instead of just one-eighth of the cookie, and they jump off the hotel, you know, and kill themselves. There's all sorts of repercussions on this with the THC limits that are up there where they're at. So I really highly suggest we need to take a hard look at not only the THC, but just don't even open up this can of worms. Right now we have a good system already set up, and it's producing the marijuana that's being used by 38,000 green card holders, and it seems to be working very well. We don't need to open up a can of worms.
All right. So we have another question that has come in through the Q&A. And it is not addressed to anyone, but we will start with Steve this time. So it reads, will legalizing marijuana reduce crime related to illegal marijuana use?
Okay, great question. That's been talked about a lot. The group, the national group that's with us is called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. So like what Pepper mentioned, we're into decriminalizing the issue of use of marijuana and then getting people help if they become addicted to it. But we're not into encouraging people to use marijuana. So the difference between having recreational approved and having our current system is not encouraging people to use it because they can't advertise. When you go into this recreational piece, you're going to see advertising second to none. You're going to see everybody being encouraged from your grandparents to your parents to your kids to your grandkids to use it because they need 110,000 people to pay back that dark money that is being invested in their campaign right now. And that's a large amount of money. Think about that. All the initiatives for the last 20 years don't add up to $8 million. This is crazy money. Something's unusual here, and it's out of state. It's dark money, and the other side will not come clean and tell us who that backer is of big marijuana.
Thank you, Steve. And Pepper, would you like to respond?
What's the question again? I'm sorry.
Yes, the question reads, will legalizing marijuana reduce crime related to illegal marijuana use?
Yeah, I think that's one of the main points here is that we're trying to decriminalize and take away the criminal penalties for marijuana use. When you legalize marijuana and you create a regulated marketplace, there's not dealers pushing to kids anymore. You know, these folks have to check IDs. They have every incentive to follow the rules, just like the medical marijuana folks in Montana. As a matter of fact, it's going to be the medical marijuana folks that you know in Montana now. When we talk about the folks that are going to take the first year of sales in Montana, it's going to be the people that are currently licensed. And so it's going to be the people that are currently making those sales. And we're going to put the black market out of business in Montana, just like they do in most of the states where they legalize. Now, California is a huge state, and California has had a very rocky program. And so, the prohibitionists say, oh, California's got a black market. California doesn't have enough inspectors to know what restaurants are licensed, much less any other businesses. And so that's not what Montana is. Montana knows exactly who these businesses are. We've been working with them for years, and so those folks are good actors, and they're going to push the black market folks out of business, and we're going to see the 130,000 people that are already consuming marijuana. We're not creating any new users. We're just bringing those folks out of the dark and into the light and bringing the money away from the cartels and bringing it into the taxpayers' pocket instead of with the Mexican cartels and the crime lords.
Thank you, Pepper. Mm-hmm. Panelists, we have time for one more question before we move on to our closing statements. And the question was emailed in. And with this one, we'll direct it first to Pepper, and then Steve can answer after that. So the question reads, Pepper, you say that tax revenue will fund public lands, but isn't it true that only the legislature can determine where the tax revenue will go? If so, why was that written into the initiative?
I think every initiative is a large amount of marketing and is a large amount of talking about what you want to do with those funds. If you look at every initiative that's ever been run in Montana, this has been the rule. And we talk about where we want this money spent, and we use the voting process to make a statement about our values as Montanans. And yes, of course, it's up to the legislature and the next governor to determine where any monies are spent. But we can sure make a statement to what our values are. And that's what we've done in the allocations and I-190, if you look at them, that's a reflection of our values. Personally, I spend about a month a year on the Missouri River fishing every year if I can. And so, you know, you see a reflection of that in the legislation, because that's something that I value and that's something that the people that worked on this valued. And we heard over and over when we spoke to folks that they wanted to see something for public lands, and specifically a statement that would remind the legislature that this is something that we as Montanans value. And so absolutely, it's up to the legislature, and we always recognize that. We want to make a strong statement and say where we want that money to go. You know, $236 million over 5 years is not a drop in the bucket, is what the opposition says, but that's quite a bit of money. I know, because I advocated for the coal industry before this, and our revenues were just a little over that. And they funded schools and local projects and local government and local police. And those are the things that we anticipate that that I-190 and the funding that's going to come from legalized, regulated, and tax marijuana will bring in.
Thank you, Pepper. And Steve, would you like to respond?
Yeah, the question's spot on. There is a huge flaw in I-190. In the Montana Constitution, Article 3, Section 4 says you cannot appropriate revenue. What the I-190 is trying to do is buy votes. They're saying, you think the Senate, the House, and the new governor is going to actually hand out the money with the way Pepper's asking it to be done? Think about that. You know, they money goes into the general fund and it's handed out probably to take care of all the problems. Like the Centennial Institute says, you're going to have $4.50 for every dollar that you bring in. If you hit 110,000 new adults out there that are smoking an ounce of pot per month with a THC content of 15% or more, that's a lot of pot. That's a lot of high to accomplish. Yes, there are people out there. The current 38,000 people that are on the green cards, they don't have to pay 20% taxation. They pay a very, very small taxation piece. Why are they going to step up to 40 or 20% taxation? Doesn't make any sense. And the current providers that are out there, they're voting no against I-190. They do not want this. They tried to come to terms. They said that this thing is flawed and has all sorts of issues in it, and they were not happy with the legislation. And that needs to be heard out there. The Montana Cannabis Industry Association, you know, if you go up on their website, you'll see that they're really opposed to this thing because of the dark money. You know, this money is not going to stay in Montana. This money is going outside to whoever this big multi.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right, gentlemen. So now we are moving on to our closing statements. Steve, if you could please provide your 2-minute closing statement first.
All righty. Well, number one, Melissa, thank you for having us. I think this has been very good. It's a good debate. In North Dakota, the same debate raged in 2018. At the end of the day, the North Dakota people voted 60-40 against it. Now, you got to remember, this is not to be confused with medical marijuana. Over there, it was approved 63-37, just like it was in 2004 here. Okay, this has to do with recreational marijuana. Do we want billboards? Do we want pot shops everywhere? Because that's really what will happen. These are not the medical marijuana shops, because they don't go out and push it on anybody. They're taking care of the public that needs the medicine. All right, it's a different deal. This is people that are in the business to stone people, to sell as much as they can, and they come with all sorts of. Now, this big dark money company that's coming in here, and we don't know who they are, and I really would like to find out who it is, so at least we know what's going to go on, and because we can go back and see what they're doing currently to the other states or in Canada. We don't know who this $4.7 million contributor is, because North Fund is not coming clean with that. And it sure would be nice for the Montana voters to know what they're voting for. Number one, Montana voters don't vote for out-of-state deals. That's what Pepper has. You know, so I don't even know why we're bringing it to Montana, why we even bring it up as Montanans when it's not a homegrown deal, and not to make fun of marijuana being grown here. The current system is adequate, number one. It's too early to tell. The Colorado, Washington, they do have increased car wrecks. There are more fatalities. There are more problems in the emergency room from the poisoning of kids eating gummy bears, dogs eating the gummy bears and the brownies. They're very high potency. So you got to really be careful on what you wish for. go talk to anybody. Go talk to the doctors, the new CEO at the Billings Clinic. He just came from Denver. He said it's a mess in the hospitals because of the legalization. So I'm not sure why we'd want to bring this to our state at this time. Let the experiments play out and just wait a little bit longer. Maybe Pepper has something, but I would suggest that we wait and we vote no on 190.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your statement. And Pepper, can we have your closing statement?
So remember, there's two initiatives. It's CI-118 and I-190. And again, this is a Montana-made piece of legislation. We cloned this from the 2019 medical marijuana statute. And so if you're familiar with the medical marijuana community and what's going on there, then you won't be surprised by anything from the new regulation. We're just offering Montanans a little more freedom. It's high time that we stop the reefer madness and the hyperbole, claiming that people are going to go into schizophrenic rage or kill their neighbor or their dog. It's outrageous. The things that have been said tonight and through the course of this campaign have been so outrageous that it's sometimes difficult to talk in response to them. I think that we as adults in Montana know better than the fear tactics that are being thrown at us. We know the truth about this. We know what our personal decisions are. If you've decided that you want to vote for this, I want to encourage you to do that. If you've got concerns about it, please go to our website. We lay it out very clearly. We spent more than a year speaking to the community about this. You know, you hear a lot of fear tactics and how things are going to go horribly. But, you know, we base this on a piece of regulation that's been very successful in Montana. And all the things that the opposition seems to want are included in our legislation, including the bans on advertising and the protections for kids, keeping the stuff out of kids' hands. We want to make sure that Montana moves into a future with their eyes wide open. The fact is that the federal government is very close to legalizing marijuana, and there's no going back, and there's no acting like that's not going to happen. We have to do this ourselves. We have to make a system that we as Montanans support. We've done that. We've spoken to the medical marijuana community in depth. To have someone who's been so vehemently opposed to marijuana speak as if they care for marijuana's community, that they care for marijuana medically, is obscene. It's using a tactic to try to get people on their side. It's very dishonest when folks say that they support medical marijuana when they've gone to war with it for several years. So, folks, if you trust yourself to make a decision, if you trust your neighbor, support I-190 and CI-118. Thank you.
Thank you, Pepper. And thank you both for being here tonight, Pepper Peterson and Steve Zabawa. It has been so educational hearing about the different perspectives regarding the initiatives that refer to legalizing marijuana. All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening and welcome back to tonight's Ballot Issues Forum. My name is Melissa Aaron. I am the moderator for tonight's event. I am the nominations chair with Bozeman Business and Professional Women. We are on the second portion of tonight's forum. We are going to be talking about LR 130, which deals with revising the concealed carry laws. Get started. I would like to first thank our sponsors for tonight's forum. They are Bozeman Business and Professional Women, the Belgrade Community Library, the Bozeman Public Library, League of Women Voters of the Bozeman Area, and American Association of University Women Bozeman. Thank you so much to our sponsors for hosting this tonight. So we have a few rules and instructions for the public who are viewing currently. If you have just signed in, we will be getting to a point of tonight's evening where you can submit questions via the Q&A feature on Zoom. So if you want to submit a question, you'll hover your mouse over the bottom of your screen. A little toolbar will pop up and you'll see an icon that says Q&A. Just select that icon and type in your question and push enter, and that will submit. It will come to me, and I will read it out loud and direct it to the panelists. Some rules about the questions. Please make sure that it is a question and not a statement. It does have to have a question mark at the end so that it's something that the panelists can answer. If a question is submitted specifically for a certain panelist, specifically for one or the other, I'll direct it to that person. But both panelists do get the option to answer if they would like to. All right. And a reminder to the panelists, when we are going through our question and answer and you're giving your responses, please keep in mind that this is a forum where we are having educational discussion, but it is not a debate. So we ask that you please be considerate and respectful with your responses and refrain from indicating your co-panelist by name directly in your response. So we are not here to call out or make accusations or judgments of co-panelists, but to state our own perspectives and our own expertise and research on the topic. So with that, we are going to get started. I'm going to give a quick little introduction before the panelists each get to introduce themselves. So tonight with us to talk about LR 130, we have Senator Dick Barrett, who is the senator for District 45 here in Montana. And Senator, if you could please wave so the audience knows who you are.
Hi there.
Thank you. Welcome. And then also this evening on audio, we don't have him on video. We have Representative Steve Gunderson, who is a representative for Montana House District 1. So Steve, if you want to say hello. And you may be muted. You may be muted, so.
Yep, sorry about that. I'm the one that's real still right up in the corner.
Great. Great, thank you. All right, so gentlemen, now we are going to go into the portion where you each can offer a 2-minute introduction for yourself so that the audience knows who you are. Let's go ahead and start with Steve, since your audio is on. Whenever you start talking, we will start the timer for 2 minutes.
Hi, my name's Representative Steve Gunderson, House District 1, up in Libby, Montana. I'm the South Lincoln County, Greater Libby, Greater Troy, and the Bull River Valley. It's actually the last best place in Montana. This is my second term, looking for my third. And I've worked with Senator Barrett a couple times on a different bills. So it's kind of nice to sit in, across from him and talk about different bills here.
Thank you very much, Representative Gunderson. And now, Senator Barrett, if you'd like to introduce yourself, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'm Senator Dick Barrett from District 45 in Missoula, which Ms. Heron has already indicated to you. I want to thank you, first of all, for inviting me to participate in this program tonight. It's an interesting opportunity, and I think I'm glad that, you know, that we're having a considered conversation about a political issue as opposed to the sort of storm of political advertising that we're facing today. So I'm looking forward to a civil and enlightening conversation. Just a little bit about myself. I am term limited. I'm completing my 12th year in the legislature and will not be going back to Helena in January because of term limits. And so you know a little bit about me. My background is that I was a economics professor at the university for 37 years and have been retired for 12 years. And during that time, I've served in the legislature. So that's what I am about.
Thank you very much, Senator. Okay. So gentlemen, now we are going to move into a time where you each have 5 minutes to present an opening statement specifically about LR 130. And let's start, please, with Senator Barrett.
Okay. The intention of LR 130 is to prevent local communities through their local governments from regulating virtually any use of firearms. That is, it eliminates the ability of local communities to have local control over an issue which is fairly critical for public safety. I would argue, and I think the opponents of LR 130 argue, that local control over these issues, local control over the issue of firearms, is important. It's needed, and that's because conditions vary from place to place. Not all regulations, not all ordinances fit all places equally. Let me give you an example. In the last, as I'm sure most people are aware, in the last couple months, there have been demonstrations all across the country in various cities that in some instances have resulted in armed confrontations between demonstrating groups and even fatal shootings. In the case of Missoula, we have not had a fatal shooting, but we have had armed groups come to Missoula to counter-protest, to protests that were going on. And those armed groups ended up illegally detaining a local Missoula teenager. I think that the opponents of LR 130 think that it's important and necessary for local communities to try and be able to deal with those kinds of situations, to be able to diffuse those situations. So that if a local community wants to say, look, we don't want armed people counter-demonstrating against one another in the streets downtown Missoula, the local government should have the power to do that. I think there are many examples of where a local community, in order to protect public safety, in order to promote public safety, should be able to adopt measures that are appropriate to that community and to its situation. We can obviously argue about the advisability of those kinds of measures, and those are legitimate policy questions. But I think what the proponents of LR 130 are doing here is they're saying, look, we don't like the way some of these decisions are being made. We don't like the way that communities are deciding how they want to regulate firearms. And so they're saying, well, instead of arguing the issue on the merits, we're just not going to allow communities to make these decisions. I think that's a wrong approach. I think we should allow communities to make those decisions, and we should consider those issues as issues of sound policy. I would also say this about LR 130, although it's clear that the intention of LR 130 is to take away local control, what's not clear is just how extensive it is. There are very significant questions about, for example, whether LR 130 takes away the ability of school boards to regulate the use of the presence of firearms at sporting events or even on school buses or in any facility that is not. Those are major issues with LR 130. I would also say that proponents of LR 130 have argued that it's going to create an unworkable patchwork of local regulations, that it's going to expose people to being charged with crimes because they don't know what the local regulations are. We have all kinds of local regulations, local ordinances. We do have a patchwork because it's appropriate to have a patchwork to meet the varying needs of varying communities. And those have not created problems in the past. I don't anticipate that they're going to create any problems in the future either. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And now, Representative Gunderson, you have 5 minutes for your opening statement.
Thank you. I guess just to start, our Second Amendment rights are fully exercisable from north to south, east to west, all across the state. What's happened is municipalities like Missoula have actually stopped us from exercising those rights. One is the, or one example would be the, they did a background check on every sale, which actually supersedes federal law. That's the patchwork that we're trying to get rid of. Again, our rights should be fully usable all across the state. Each municipality should not have the ability to set or deny any of those rights that are given to us by our Second Amendment. And actually, if I have a concealed weapons permit, that permit is good, again, from border to border, all across the state. And if a municipality wants to stop me from using that, I guess that's where I think LR 130 is going to stop that and give us the right to do, to use our Second Amendment rights, again, from border to border, all across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gunderson, for your statement. And to clarify, since we don't have video for the audience, Representative Gunderson is here providing perspective support to LR 130. And then Senator Barrett is here providing perspectives opposing LR 130. So we're going to move on now to some questions that are coming in from the public. The first question is a question that was submitted in advance. And it is not addressed to either panelist. However, I will go ahead and direct this first to Representative Gunderson. And it reads thus. LR 130 generally restricts a county, city, town, or local government from its authority to regulate the carrying of firearms, and federal and other state firearm restrictions would remain unchanged. Can you please explain in common language what this would mean if LR 130 passed and what it would mean if LR 130 did not pass? You have 90 seconds.
Well, if LR 130 passed, it means that the city of Missoula can't enact a law that would deny me the capability of carrying a concealed weapons if I had a concealed weapons permit. If it doesn't pass, then Missoula now has the right, if I'm driving through the town, and I'd point out that while I'm outside town, I can actually legally carry once I get into the city jurisdiction, I can't. So that's what we're trying to do, is get rid of that mishmash of local restrictions on a Second Amendment right that should be good all across the country. Okay.
Thank you very much for that comment, Representative. And Senator Barrett, would you also like to address this question? And you are muted, just so you know.
Thank you. Sure. The city of Missoula and no city in Montana can violate the Second Amendment. The kind of restrictions that Representative Gunderson is talking about are not restrictions that violate the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court has made it perfectly clear that local governments or any government has the ability to regulate guns in certain ways, in certain limited and specified ways. And if a city tries to regulate guns in some way that isn't allowed, you can go to court. In fact, the regulation that Representative Gunderson has referred to about about background checks, the Missoula regulation about background checks, was thrown out by courts. What this amendment does is not protect citizens from having their Second Amendment rights violated. What it does is it prevents communities from exercising perfectly constitutional rights to control firearms.
Thank you, Senator. All right, the next question that has come in is not addressed to either panelist. However, I'll direct it first to Senator Barrett, and it reads, would a vote no on LR 130 have a negative impact on Montana's professional licensure statutes? The initiative language is confusing, and I would like to know if there would be impacts on those licensure statutes.
Well, I'm not sure I understand. I'm not sure I understand the question. Would it have a negative impact? Is there any clarification of what licensure statutes are being referred to there?
So it just reads Montana's professional licensure statutes. However, if the person who typed in this question wants to expand on what they mean, I'll be able to see it come in. So
thank you. Could we wait for some amplification of that question? Because I don't really know what professional licensure statutes are being referred to in the question.
Yeah, that's acceptable. We can wait and see if a clarification comes in from that audience.
Maybe Representative Gunderson would like to take that one on, and I'd like to hear what he answers, because I don't think I understand the question.
Senator Barrett, I'm not sure if I'm as brave as I should be here, but I'll try to answer it. If it's a licensure for a professional, like a barber or some regulated business, I don't think it will. Again, we have to go back. The Second Amendment rights are state rights. Concealed carry is a state authorized function. And I do think that at some point we will go to a permitless carry, and then that will pretty much take care of anything across the state. You won't have to have a permit. I mean, that's as close as I can come to answering that.
Thank you, Representative. So if some clarifying information comes in from the person that submitted that, we'll readdress this question and both parties can answer again. Thank you. So the next question that has come in, this is directed to Representative Gunderson. And it reads, if this passes, can a person carry a gun at work? I think you've
good made- question. What type of work does he do?
Closed.
If he's a police officer, hey, we got that one covered. I believe businesses can tell you that you can't carry a gun, on a workplace. That's private property. And I guess I'm not really understanding the question exactly. But I would take it that, if it's a workplace, I think workplace is covered also by federal law too.
All right. Thank you, Representative. And Senator Barrett, would you like to pose an answer to that question?
Well, yeah, I don't think that there, so far as I know, there is no local ordinance anywhere in Montana that that addresses the question of whether people can have guns at work. And so if it passed, there would be no local ordinance that was invalidated that would change that situation. But what we do know is that if it passes, all existing ordinances respecting guns would be invalidated. I doubt, as I say, that there's one regarding carrying guns at work, but I don't think that the effect of the ordinance passing or not passing on carrying guns at work is that there is any impact of the ordinance on carrying guns at work, but it would invalidate any other regulations that are local regulations that are out there in the form of an ordinance.
Thank you, Senator. All right, so the next question. Again, this is directed to Mr. Gunderson, Representative Gunderson. What government entity will issue permits if adopted?
There won't be any change. Your local sheriff is the one that issues a concealed carry weapon permit. It's not going to change anything there, because all we're changing is that a local municipality cannot restrict any law that's more restrictive than the state's. And I'm having a terrible time here. I've got a lot of reverberation. But I would just say that it's not making any change. It's just not allowing a city or a municipality to set laws that are more strict than the state laws.
Thank you for clarifying. And Senator, would you like to answer that question?
Well, I agree with Representative Gunderson that I don't think that passing this resolution or not passing it would have any material effect on who issues concealed weapons permits. I don't think that question is involved here. I would say that I think that that to some extent I disagree with Representative Gunderson on the question of what the resolution would prohibit was only things that are more restrictive than state law. It is the case that state law is silent on a number of issues where local governments might want not to be silent. What this resolution would do is on any issue of gun regulation where state law is silent, local governments could not have a voice. They could not have any local control over an issue where the state law is silent.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. And the next question is also directed towards Representative Gunderson, and it reads, if LR 130 passes with the existing federal regulation, what type of regulations apply to individuals carrying with a mental issue carrying guns, or are there regulations on military type weapons that can be used to kill large numbers of people quickly?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. First, the second part changes nothing at the federal level of having automatic weapons being illegal. They aren't legal. This won't change that. And again, it's not there other than to make sure they're revising firearms laws to secure the right to keep and bear arms. And we're restricting that patchwork of restrictions by local governments. Could you give me that first part of that?
Yes. So it read, with the federal and state regulations, are there regulations on individuals who have mental issues carrying concealed weapons? And you have 45
seconds. Again, LR 130 has no contact with that part of it. That's in state law already. That's in federal law already. LR 130 does not address that at all, does not change anything. So it's kind of a moot question.
Thank you. And Senator, would you like to offer a response or clarification?
Sure. It's true that LR 130 obviously has no impact on federal regulations. But I do think there's an example here that's important. And what would LR 130 prohibit? Suppose that a local government wanted to have a red flag law. And under red flag laws, the police can take the guns out of a house of somebody who's threatening to kill himself or somebody else. Those laws are constitutional. They have passed muster in the courts. They are consistent with the Second Amendment. So what if a local government wanted to have a law like that to allow the police to enter a home and take guns away from somebody who was threatening his or her own life or the life of those around him, the local government couldn't do that under LR 130.
Thank you, Senator. All right, so the next question that has come in, it's not addressed to either of you, but let's start with Senator Barrett. And it reads, what is considered a justifiable need to carry a concealed firearm in Montana?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think you have to justify the need to carry a concealed to get a concealed weapons permit in Montana. I don't think that under the law you have to demonstrate a need. I may be mistaken about that, but maybe Representative Gunderson has a better answer on that one.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Byrd, I do. There is no requirement. It's a right. You do have to have a background check. You do have to have some training. I've carried a concealed weapons permit for many, many years, but I've also been trained in the military, and I've spent years teaching my kids how to safely use weapons. So there isn't any justification that you need. It's just if you're able to carry it, if you're mentally incompetent, you can't get it. If you're a convicted felon, you can't. If you're an illegal alien, you can't. If you're a minor, you can't. Those are already laws in place. LR 130 won't change them.
Thank you, Representative. And I'll speak loudly because it's raining where I am. So hopefully you can hear my voice still. We have one more question that was submitted, and it is directed to Representative Gunderson. It reads, Representative Gunderson, how do you reconcile your position that cities are not able to regulate firearms with other local regulations, such as the prohibition of firearms in the state capital? Do you think those regulations are also invalid?
The Second Amendment right, the right to keep and bear arms is a right. We've been restricted by a little sign on the door of the Capitol that says, no guns past this point. So I guess there is no real justification.
current administration decided that they didn't want guns inside the state capitol. Is it a law? Nope. Is it something that we have to follow? Probably not. If you're carrying concealed, is somebody going to check at the door? It's a sign.
Thank you, Representative. And Senator?
As far as I know, people have not supposed to be carrying guns in the Capitol long before the current administration. I do not think it was a decision of the current administration to prohibit guns in the Capitol. They've been prohibited in my 12 years in the legislature. So on that point, I think it's important to understand that when we talk about Second Amendment rights, they are not absolute. The courts have made it abundantly clear. Judge Alito in the Heller decision made it absolutely clear that governments do have the right to restrict certain kinds of guns, certain locations for guns, certain people having guns. Those kinds of restrictions are, in the opinion of the United States Supreme Court, consistent with Second Amendment rights. Second Amendment rights are not absolute. So when we're talking about the kinds of regulations that local governments are contemplating or have enacted in the past, they are not violations of Second Amendment rights. They may not be good ideas. We may dispute that one way or the other, but it's not correct to say that they violate the Second Amendment of the Constitution. If they did, a court would have tossed them out a long time ago.
Thank you, Senator. And one more question has actually come in. And this is addressed first to Representative Gunderson, and then we'll go to Senator Barrett. So this question reads, Representative Gunderson, you mentioned that the sign at the state capitol is a request not to carry firearms inside. You also mentioned that a business has the power to prohibit firearms inside their business. How exactly does the Second Amendment apply or not apply to businesses?
I'm not quite following what they're asking.
I'll read it again.
Okay.
So it sounds like they just want some clarification. Where it was said that on the state capitol there's a sign that restricts people from entering to carry their concealed firearm inside the capitol. Similarly, earlier Representative Gunderson has said that it would be okay for a business to prohibit people from bringing firearms inside. How does the Second Amendment apply or not apply to a business restricting carrying firearms inside?
Well, I would actually give you one example. A mine site, mining site that is under MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, they are, any workers prohibited from taking a gun onto lands that are under their purview. And again, that's a private business. I guess there would be certain businesses that you wouldn't want to have a gun present. And I believe that would be like a bar where they serve alcohol as the single product. I'm hoping that answers your question.
Thank you. And Senator Barrett, would you like to respond to the question?
Sure. I think what you're dealing with when you talk about business owners prohibiting people from bringing guns into the business, whatever the business might be, is a potential conflict between the gun owner's Second Amendment rights and the property owner's property rights. I think we all would admit, for example, that as a homeowner, you're perfectly within your rights to tell people, no, you cannot bring a gun into my home. And I think that the same thing applies to a business owner. A business owner's property rights to control how his property is used and occupied supersedes the Second Amendment rights of a potential client who might want to walk in with a gun. But in LR, in the case of LR 130, we're not talking about a conflict between property rights and gun owners' rights. We're talking about what may be a conflict between the public's right to protect itself and a gun owner's right. But as I've said a couple times now, and I'll say one more time, the kinds of restrictions that we're talking about here that local governments have adopted through ordinance do not violate the Second Amendment rights of gun owners. They are, as the Supreme Court has said, consistent with the Second Amendment.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you both. So now we are out of questions and we are ready to move on to our closing statements. Reminder that your closing statement is 2 minutes in length. I'd like to ask Senator Barrett to begin first with a closing statement regarding LR 130.
Okay, I'll sort of pick up where I left off in terms of my opening remarks, and that is that, as I said before, I think that what LR 130 does is it violates an important principle that we hold to be quite important in Montana, and that is the idea of local control, that localities should be able to adopt ordinances that fit their conditions. Most of the ordinances that LR 130 would prohibit are ordinances that are designed to meet the specific needs of communities as they have identified those needs. Not as some legislator from some other town has identified them, but as how they have identified them. I do not think that creating different ordinances in different places creates a unworkable patchwork or exposes people to unreasonable risk of violating the law, or let alone violates their Second Amendment rights. I think that we can have and should have local ordinances that meet local needs to and exercise local control over in a reasonable way that's consistent with the U.S. Constitution and with the Montana Constitution and with Montana law, that that recognizes that local communities do want to regulate the use of firearms in certain circumstances. So that's it.
Thank you very much, Senator. And Representative Gunderson, your closing statement.
LR 130 is a very simple bill. All it does is actually remove the ability for local governments such as Missoula to set more stricter laws than what the actual state laws are. Can you hear me? Because I think I lost my audio again.
We can hear you. You may continue.
Okay, I can't hear you, but let me continue. The LR 130 will just do away with a mishmash of laws that each of the cities put into place. Again, like Missoula, my concealed carry permit is issued by a sheriff of the county, and it says Montana State Concealed Weapons Permit. So again, that permit should be usable. I'm fully legal and fully capable of exercising my rights anywhere in the state. If it's a local city like Missoula,
They shouldn't be able to set any laws that tell me that I can't follow state law, which is legal, and I've been given the right to carry a concealed weapon. And mostly LR-130, if you read the actual statement at the top of it, it says may not regulate the carrying of concealed weapons provided the proposed act to be submitted to the qualified electors. So it's actually going to the people. And looks like I have to stop. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, Senator Barrett and Representative Gunderson, for being here to talk about LR-130. This has been really informative, and you've answered a lot of questions. We thank you for being here. Thank you, Senator Barrett.
Thank you.
With that, I believe we are ready to get started, and I'd love to invite Representative Gunderson to please introduce yourself. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, I'm Representative Steve Gunderson, House District 1, Greater Libby, Greater Troy, and the Bull River Valley, the last best place in Montana. And I'm actually the author and ran C-46 and C-47 through the legislature. So I look forward to discussing what the differences are of passing or not passing the amendments.
Thank you very much. And Representative Funk?
Yes, hi, I'm Mafi Funk. I'm looking to have my final term. I hope to be termed out rather than voted out this coming session. And I live in Helena and sort of central Helena, which is the best part, was voted one of the best communities in the nation. And it really is. And I go out to the valley and I was a former middle school social studies teacher. So how fabulous is that? And thank you so much for having us.
Thank you both so much for being here. So now we have time for 5-minute opening statements from each of you regarding C-46 and C-47. Let's start with Representative Funk.
Well, thank you. I sort of thought that Representative Gunderson would go first, and my opening statement was going to be he's absolutely correct. I have absolutely there's nothing nefarious in these two constitutional amendments. All they do is put into proper language what we're already doing. So they're, in that sense, they are absolutely simple. The reason I voted against them, and many people, both sides of the aisle, did vote against them in the House. It passed almost unanimously out of the Senate. The reason I voted, two reasons. One, it was for me, it was ballot clutter. This is a presidential election year. We knew we were going to have a lot of things on the ballot, and this simply was not necessary to put on it. I have had more calls about what does this mean than any other issue, any other thing on the ballot, because we don't have language that allows us to be clear and concise. If we could just say, this just puts the language in to do what we're already doing, then that would be clear, but we can't do it that way. So we have this convoluted language that it should be simple and it's not. So, and for me, it was ballot clutter. We didn't need it on this kind of issue, because what if Representative Gunderson had brought a bill saying when something is declared unconstitutional, because the way the language was written was unconstitutional, then we can just get rid of it. I would have voted for that 100%. We have there's so many things that are in code on that are actually unconstitutional, but they stay because we have to go through a process to get rid of them, to get them off the books. Things that are some stream access laws, the same-sex marriage, all these things are still on the books, because we don't have a good way of getting rid of them. Last election, we had that one, the safety ballot, which then a lot of people voted for it because it had a very catchy title, Protect Your Ballot, Voting Protection. And then they came in and they had to sign all these papers or sign a form to deposit their spouse's ballot, which sent them, they were pretty upset about that. And it has been, and they found out that they had voted for it. And it's unconstitutional, but it's still there in law. So, and LR 130, there are many, many lawyers who think that it will be taken to court as unconstitutional. And then what do we do? If it should pass, then it's another thing that we just have to deal with. Lawyers might like these things, but we need a process that when something, when our courts have declared something unconstitutional, as they did with the former language in 46 and 47, we can just get through them and rather than having to clutter up our ballots. So that's why I voted no, but there's nothing wrong with them.
Thank you very much, Representative. And so now we can hear an opening statement from Representative Gunderson, who was the author, again, of C-46 and C-47. Representative?
Representative Funk, you and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of issues, but I guess this is one that we see eyeball to eyeball. Kind of nice for once. I think I disagree with you. C-46 and C-47 are very important. They are laws that set the standards for qualifying signatures for constitutional amendments and initiatives. And it's truly, truly, both of these are cleanups. The language is convoluted. The language is confusing. And when it was found unconstitutional, it should have been struck. But it was done by a federal district court, and they don't have the power to remove language like, say, the Supreme Court would. What's wrong with each one of these? C-46, the way it reads is what you're reading on the screen right now must be signed by at least 10% of the qualified electors in 2/5 of the legislative districts. Keywords, legislative districts. In 2002, one of my senators, Senator Cushmore, and a group changed or tried to change that, put it in as a voter initiative. They changed the words legislative districts to counties. And a federal district court found that unconstitutional, which I really agree with. Legislative districts are equal representation all across the state. We have 100 House districts, or you take 2 House districts to make a single senator district. And so it's equal representational across the board. Changing it to counties rather than legislative districts made an imbalance. And they were trying to raise the bar, but they did it the wrong way. And that's how I got actually started on C-46 and C-47. I was trying to do something totally different, but the convoluted language here just preempted me from getting it done. As you can tell, Representative Funk made it very clear. It was hard to explain. You tell one story, but what's actually printed in our books is something different, and the way they count is something different again. So it's very confusing, very convoluted. All these two are doing is removing that word counties, I believe half counties, and reinserting the legislative districts. So it's just a cleanup bill. And again, it was to try to raise the bar to give equal representation on voter initiatives across the board. Simple bill, but convoluted answer to try to explain the long story that goes with it. And again, it's just it's an easy yes on both C-46, C-47 to allow us to pull out unconstitutional language and replace it with the constitutional, original constitutional language that says legislative districts. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Gunderson, for your opening statement. So we have a few questions that have come in from the public. And the first question is directed to Representative Gunderson. And it reads, in the 2020 voter information pamphlet, the language in C-47 specifies a minimum number of legislative districts by using the words at least. In C-46, the words at least are struck out, and it seems to specify an exact number of legislative districts. What is the difference and why?
That's a bit of a loaded question. Again, it's the original language from the Constitution. It's reverting back to what was originally there. Both are C-46 is pretty much dealing with constitutional amendment by initiative, and it states at least 10%. So it's looking for a minimum number of the qualified electors in 2/5 of the legislative districts. Again, the only difference in language that is in our books is, I believe, half of the counties. And that's the only language that's being changed. And again, that change is a reverting back to original language. So we aren't changing anything. And we're not, again, like Representative Funk said, no smoke, no mirrors. We're not doing anything nefarious. It's just cleaning up language and returning it back to constitutional language that was there before. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gunderson. And Representative Funk, would you like to address that question as well?
Well, we're just buddy-buddy tonight because he's absolutely correct. It just cleans up the language. And to help people understand, if you did counties, then you could, because counties have very different population, but legislative districts are based on population. So by putting this based on the number of legislative districts, you even that playing field so that it's numbers of people rather than the counties, which can be so diverse. And again, this is absolutely straightforward. It just takes us back to what it was. I just wish that we could either have a bill that said you have to speak in plain language, and because legislative language is complex, and it has very rigid standards and ways you have to phrase something. You can look at any bill. That's why we have experts to help us write the bills. But it just seemed this changes nothing. This is the way we are doing it now. It changes nothing. So it just seemed unnecessary to put it on the ballot when we have so many other things. And it just seemed unnecessary. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Representative Funk. So we have one more question on this. The public has given us some comments saying, thank you both so much for clarifying this, because many people were confused about the language. So that helped a lot. So the final question that has come in, and let's start with Representative Gunderson. It reads, what are some potential unintended consequences that you see of this either passing or not passing?
Oh, excellent question. And I brought this up to Elsie Arntzen, our OPI. If we don't pass it, if I hand a school child one of our little books that gives us the kind of the Reader's Digest version of the Constitution, they may get a copy that says 1/2 of the counties. They may get 2/5 of the legislative districts. As we read through our MCA manuals, the Constitution is listed in there, and as Representative Funk said, it's convoluted. There's a bunch of footnotes that explain a 2002 bill that was found unconstitutional in 2005, and it goes on and on and on and on. So how do we teach our children what's correct if we have convoluted, confusing language in the Constitution? Let's say yes and just remove that unnecessary language from both C-46 and C-47.
Thank you very much. And Representative Funk, would you like to address that question?
Well, that was an excellent answer, Representative Gunderson, because I hadn't thought of that thing. I'd love to think that people read our Constitution and rules and code that closely. This changes this, as we have said so many times, this changed nothing. We are doing it the way that it originally was before the 2002 bill. So this changes nothing. The only reason I would vote no on it, because as we've said so many times, it is a perfectly straightforward thing. The only reason I would vote no on it is then Representative Gunderson is going to have to come back this coming session and pass a law where we just do it. We do something that does it automatically, so we don't have to go back and bother voters with this convoluted language.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Funk. So now we are finished with questions from the public, and we're ready to go on to closing statements. So I'd like to please ask Representative Gunderson for a 2-minute closing statement.
How about if I make this the shortest statement on record? Yes means that we're cleaning up language that shouldn't be there. No means that we're leaving it in and we're leaving convoluted, confusing language where it shouldn't be. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you very much. And Representative Funk, a closing statement.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this. This was fun. And all the people who have called me, I've explained why I voted no, but I have told them there is no reason. You can choose vote yes or vote no. This changes nothing. I think the language is still convoluted. That's the way we write laws. We make them confusing. My only concern, too, is that we cherry pick. Well, let's change this. Let's make this so that we get it out of the books. And it would seem to me so much more streamlined and efficient to just have a way through either the legislature or through our courts that when they say something is unconstitutional, it gets stricken and we don't have to go through this this procedure and make our ballots even longer.
Thank you, Representative Funk. All right. So I want to extend a huge thank you to both the representatives here with us now, Gunderson and Funk, for being here to talk about these issues. This was very informative and helpful. And a huge thank you to all of the panelists and all of the candidates who participated in this 2 weeks worth of forums. We had 4 evenings. It was very informative. Everyone's participation was extremely helpful and educational. Thank you again to our sponsors, Bozeman Business and Professional Women, the League of Women Voters of the Bozeman Area, American Association of University Women, the Belgrade Community Library, and the Bozeman Public Library for putting this virtual webinar together. All of the evenings of this forum series have been recorded. So audience members, you can go watch them again. You can share them with friends who may not have been able to tune in. Panelists and participants, you can watch them. They are located on the YouTube channel for the Belgrade Community Library. So you have to go to YouTube and then type in Belgrade Community Library and find their channel. You can also go to bozemanbpw.org. It's on the homepage. So a reminder for everyone, your absentee ballots have already been sent out. If you aren't registered to vote, you can do so by visiting the Secretary of State website at sosmt.gov/elections. Voter registration closes on October 26th. Ballots can be completed and turned in via mail or in person at a polling location or in person to the county courthouse on election day, November 3rd. On election day, November 3rd, the same day voter registration and in-person voting will be available to you from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You have all day. Thank you again, everyone, for being active participants in our democracy. I'll now adjourn the forum and shut down the webinar. Everybody, have a good night.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much. Take care, Steve. Bye-bye. Thank you, Melissa. Thanks, Sarah. Bye-bye, everyone.